The accusation heard more and more that Israel is engaging in genocide and colonialism will resonate with many people who ordinarily are Israel's friend. Lastly, this war will profoundly affect Israeli democracy, further dividing the country and inviting government decisions that undermine human rights and the rule of law. In short, Israel's war on Hamas is increasing the country's insecurity, just as surely as it is increasing human insecurity for Palestinians. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff, David Rosenberg, and Birdie. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Roz Brown, Danielle Smith, Shantaya Hudson, Farah Siddiqui, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Birdie. The coverage of the Gaza war in Western media outlets has included news about the suffering caused by the Israeli bombardment, but some commentators believe that the mainstream media reporting is leaving out something very important. Richard Eskow is the host and managing editor of The Zero Hour. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
What are people missing, or what is the U.S. and Western media missing when they're reporting on the Israel-Gaza situation? I mean, they're certainly reporting about the humanitarian crisis and people being evacuated and hospitals being attacked, etc. But is there something more there?
Absolutely. There's a global pattern underway that's being ignored that is so important to understand what's going on. We all know, if we've been following this story at all, about the International Court of Justice, a ruling that there was reasonable suspicion of genocide in Israel's attack on Gaza, but the systematic nature of that action it seems to be clear to everyone except the U.S. government and Western media. And I suspect it may be more clear than we're given to understand. And what I mean by that is this, is some of the characteristics of a genocide are rendering an area uninhabitable, trying to force people out of an area they live in, making sure that there are no conditions that make it livable in terms of either homes, healthcare, food, energy, water supply, all of the things that make living possible. The systematic nature of the attack on Gaza, the administration has taken to, I think in response to polling, has taken to clucking from time to time about this attack on this hospital or that attack on that refugee camp. But what we're seeing is systematic in a couple ways, one of which is geographic. When the assault on Gaza began, the people of Gaza were told to move from the north toward the south, which has significance we'll get to in a minute. But they began doing so, many of them, perhaps most of them at this point. The vast majority of Gazans are reportedly refugees driven from their homes. And they began to move south as they were told to do. But the destruction by Israel was not limited to the south. They were struck and attacked along their way, moving southward. As they moved down, we saw a pattern, not one-to-one, but a clear pattern of widening bombing of infrastructure throughout Gaza.
But now, they're going after Hamas, and that Hamas is using these people as a shield. So it's unavoidable, even though they're attempting to do surgical strikes. Is there any merit to that?
First of all, there's no evidence for that. In fact, all of the evidence is overwhelmingly in the opposite. All of the evidence tells us that they are using broad assaults on civilian populations. It should also be noted that under international law, the so-called quote-unquote human shield defense is often not applicable. It's not allowable to say, for example, there has to be a principle proportionality, so that if you believe, as an Israeli military leader, that there is one Hamas soldier in the basement of an apartment building housing 1,200 people, under international law, it's illegal because it's disproportionate to destroy the entire building and the people living in it, which is a principle that gets lost. We've also found time and again that these stories of bases or centers of operation under hospitals, for example, have turned out to be false, and the propaganda films have been debunked by a very good international group, but based in the UK, I believe, called Forensic Architecture, that's done a lot of analyses of these so-called videos, debunking them. So, that's not a defense. B, there is no element of proportionality to it. And, there are certain targets that are forbidden under most circumstances, including hospitals, schools, and things of that nature that have been particularly targeted, essentially of, I believe it was something like 35 functioning hospitals in Gaza. There are now none. For example, clinics have been destroyed and so on. So we're seeing, I think there are a couple hospitals running at semi-functional, at the last report was 4 times capacity. And now the latest stage is having driven the civilian population, the surviving civilian population, southward to a large extent. They're bombing them there. Now, Israel has said from the beginning that, and there have been reports of individual members of the Biden administration discussing this idea as well, that now that they're all at Rafah, which is the Rafah crossing, or near there, which is very close to the south, now that there's a gathering of refugees there, attacks on them in their refugee camps, and then stories of an upcoming major military assault, they have no place to go except across the Rafah crossing into Egypt and the Sinai Desert, which has been a stated objective of the Israeli government, according to military planning papers that have been released. They've never officially said so. But if you look at all these elements, the destruction of medical infrastructure, the blockade of food, the cutoff of water, and then the bombing patterns driving them southward, now trying to drive them across the border into Sinai, every single element of this is genocidal in effect. So it's hard to believe, particularly since they've discussed plans of this kind, it's hard to believe that it's not also genocidal intent. But regardless of intent, these patterns of behavior are against international law. They're war crimes.
And meanwhile, there are former Gaza settlers, Israeli settlers, who are talking about going back because it seems like they understand that the object was to depopulate Gaza so that maybe they could go back.
Yes, I think that's a secondary benefit. I mean, I think the primary goal is that Israel doesn't want Palestine or Palestinians around. And Gaza is the most vulnerable population for them. But as we know, they've also intensified attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank, whether that's phase two or not is a matter of speculation. But the idea is to get Palestinians out, at which point, of course, settlers could come back in. And just very briefly, people thought it was a humanitarian gesture on Israel's part. That's how it was presented in the West when they removed their settlers from Gaza, but they had very few of them. And what they chose to do instead was to create a literal concentration camp where they could isolate a minority population, which again is an act of criminality. So I think the settlers are getting ready to move back to where they've been. We've seen countless videos of Israeli soldiers boasting that they've leveled residential areas, that they'd make good farmland. I think one video I saw said, and so on. So, yeah, we can imagine that could well be an end product if this plan is successful.
So it's kind of just like old-fashioned conquest, maybe even going back to biblical days when the Israelites came into the land of Canaan and defeated the various groups that were there, because God had promised them the land, that kind of thing.
Right. The Canaan analogy is great. We hear a lot about the people of Israel's or the Jewish people's 2,000-year history in that land, which genetically, I suppose, well, I do have the right of return in Israel if they don't investigate me too carefully. But as exactly as you said, if you study the history, they invaded and displaced the Canaanite tribes. So that would mean that any invader has the right of occupation, number one, which doesn't seem right. And number two, I've also done genetic studies of the descendants of the Canaanites and find that while Jews like me have some of that DNA, that is not the win for the Israel argument they claim it is, because Palestinians have much more and Lebanese have much more and other Arab populations in the region have much more. So it's grotesque to use DNA anyway to overrule the rights of property and self-determination. But even if you go down that road, there's no argument or no justification for what's being done now.
Have you seen much reference in the U.S. media to the idea of ethnic cleansing? Is that something they avoid as well as this larger pattern you mentioned earlier?
It's definitely something that I think is avoided in the mainstream media and strongly rebuffed when it's brought up in questioning at State Department press conferences or White House press conferences.
They did use it in Bosnia because the whole idea was to be against the Bosnian Serbs.
We could also, if I could find it right now, I would, but we could also take President Biden's language verbatim regarding Putin and Ukraine and substitute Israel and Gaza, and it would be exactly the same. So, yes, of course, they will use the language of ethnic cleansing when it suits them tactically, and rebuff it when it does not. They'll use the language of war criminality when it suits them and not when it doesn't. But this is, in terms of historical references and touchstones, a classic case of ethnic cleansing. It should be seen that way.
What about the people who are now around Rafah or in Rafah? Egypt doesn't want them coming in. And so what's going to happen? Any predictions?
Well, it's hard to say because, Egypt's initial response, I think, was based primarily on the burden, financial and otherwise, that they felt they might take on by letting them in.
They already have more than 200,000. Yeah.
Right. And if you think about a million or more, that's a significant demographic block in Egypt. It's also potentially politically destabilizing. So I think self-interest was one of their prime reasons. I think they were probably also concerned. They stated anyway in the public statements that they were concerned about enabling a genocide by allowing the Israelis to force Palestinians out. I strongly suspect, I don't know, but I would be surprised if the U.S. was not continuing to pursue what we've heard hints about in the past, which is heavy-duty negotiation with the Gulf states, the oil states, to subsidize the cost to Egypt, perhaps with some sort of token acknowledgement of a two-state, solution of recognition of a Palestinian state, so that the ethnic cleansing is, much like the United States did with treaties with American Indians, pretending to acknowledge their nationhood even as they were destroying their nations. We might see something like that. It's really too hard to tell, though, now.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
Yeah, the one thing that I would like certainly everybody to know, because this gets misunderstood so often, is we keep hearing Democrats, including President Biden and Senate Democrats, referring to their $95 billion war bill as an aid bill. First of all, they coyly describe the $14 billion for Israel as security assistance rather than what it is, military aid for an ongoing genocide. But secondly, they insist there is humanitarian aid for Gaza. There is none specified, none. In fact, it enacts into law a complete ban against UNRWA, the UN relief organization, which has the main infrastructure for delivering aid to Gaza. That's part of the genocidal plan to destroy all possibility of aid. It's been an informal ban from the State Department and the White House, but that makes it official. UNRWA got $120 million since October 7th from the United States. So that's a huge cutoff in aid with no promise of additional aid to come. And that's catastrophic.
That was Richard Eskow, the host of The Zero Hour on Free Speech TV, speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Bertie. Thanks for being with us.
Loving. Our guests are Eli Spivak and Shannon Wilson from Electrify PDX. They're helping people convert their homes away from natural gas to all electric utilities. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
What is Electrify PDX, Shannon?
So we are a nonprofit certification program. We help homeowners and renters transition their homes from natural gas, also old electric resistance appliances and systems, to really efficient electric systems for their homes. The way that we do that is that we have yard signs that people can sign up and put out in front of their home to let their neighbors and community know what they're doing. Then as they change out their systems over time, they can put badges on the signs. And then when it's completely transitioned to all electric with renewable energy, they can get a nice certification plaque to put outside their home.
That's neat. You're prompting the neighbors to talk to each other.
Exactly. It's about creating public awareness so that we can kind of speed that transition.
Eli, why is this program important now?
The time is right for this. People are devastated by all the climate issues. But one thing we can do is make our houses not generate greenhouse gases. You can get a heat pump water heater 3 times more efficient than a resistance electric one or a gas one. You can get green power programs, or you can do community solar, reduce your electric bill, and you've got 100% clean energy. So by doing those things, you can bring your carbon impact of your house down to zero. And people are already doing it. For those folks who are low income, Portland passed the Portland Clean Energy Fund. So there's huge amounts of resources to help people get free systems. It's really, the time is now. This is something to be excited about, and we can take action now.
Shannon, can you talk about how the program works exactly? You can be a renter or a homeowner.
Exactly, yeah. So about 47% of Portlanders are renters, so we want to make sure that they're included in our program. It's really about joining this movement, making your neighbors and family and friends aware of what you're doing, and being really intentional about it. We offer a monthly newsletter. We have an online list of contractors who are electrification friendly. We also hold events, so we host neighborhood association presentations. We also hold an annual electrification fair called Electrify Portland. We had our last one in October, and we'll have another one next September. And it's really just about connecting people with the resources that they need and helping them kind of step through the process with resources, advice, connections with the contractors that are going to be reliable and friendly.
This is a complicated zone. How do people participate with you? Where do they start?
Oftentimes, people encounter us at our community presentations. We suggest that people visit our website, which is electrifypdx.org, where it's really easy to sign up for our program. If your home is already 100% electric, powered by renewable energy, you can just go straight to the certification stage as well.
I wanted to also ask you, who's coming in to participate with it?
They're definitely affluent Portlanders, and we're helping them find a contractor who's going to help them do it. We've also got a woman, a mobile home park in Portland. She got her home all electric. She put a heat pump into it and dropped her electric utility bills from $300 to $100 a month. There's also a woman in North Portland, and she's worked with the Community Energy Project. Her home was already electric, but she has a heat pump water heater, solar PV, and a huge champion in that neighborhood. We work with people at every income level for sure. We presented numbers of churches, real estate agents, city festivals. We're just trying to make it easy.
You're getting people face to face. That's interesting. You just mentioned the Community Energy Project. Can you talk a little bit about other community projects that participate with you?
Yeah, one of the early things we did was work with PSEF, with a mini grant, to help create a one-stop shop where people could learn about all the resources. There are opportunities with Verde to get a free heat pump, you know, with Community Energy Project to insulate your home, to get a counselor to help figure out what changes to make to your house. There's many choices out there, and PSEF is doing another funding round right now. So it's really critical with global warming to make sure that low-income neighbors get to transition first. And Portland has raised the funds to do that. So we really want to make sure there's a place people can learn what's available to them. We want to make those connections.
PSEF, Portland Clean Energy Community Benefits Fund. Eli, talk about what is PSEF? Why is it important?
PSEF was really, we're a leader in the country on this. We should be proud. It's a tax on affluent residents. It goes towards making sure that we have a climate justice program in Portland that has real money behind it to make sure that folks who are the most impacted by heat waves get air conditioning. It makes sure that when we have our neighborhoods, we have shade equity. We don't have some neighborhoods that are boiling hot with no trees and other neighborhoods that are cool and shaded.
PSEF is different. There's real money there.
It takes local capacity in the nonprofit sector. And when there hasn't been money to support nonprofit run programs, the capacity isn't there. So now there's a huge amount of money and capacity is growing. And hopefully we'll be able to administer all these funds by nonprofits. But the nonprofits have a growth curve to go to.
And now I have to ask you my mom Betty's question. She says you can't electrify everything because you need some fossil fuels to run the electrical utilities on some level. What's the response to that? I've heard that from other people.
It's a good question from your mom. Thanks for the question. There's a couple of different levels at this question. First of all, we absolutely should be going all electric in our homes. There are uses for natural gas that are helpful in industrial situations, but we don't need to be using that to make our homes warm or cool. In the residential sector, there's no question we should be going all electric. In Oregon, we are requiring our utilities to clean up their electric supply so it's renewable.
2040 is the deadline for Oregon.
So that means if you just buy regular electricity from your utility, it's going to be cleaning up automatically. And you don't have to wait either because you can sign up for community solar now and get clean energy immediately. Community solar is great for everyone who has an electric bill. Oregon, in their wisdom, realized that a lot of people don't own their home, they're renters. Their roof might not face the right direction or be shaded, so they created a community solar. They actually subsidize it so that if you sign up for that, you get electricity from a locally developed PV farm.
Wow.
And your bill goes down by like 5%. And if you're low income, your bill goes down by like 30%. You have to go through the Community Energy Project to sign up. It can be an individual's home. It can be a business. It could be a condo association. Anyone's got an electric bill can sign up.
Can I just follow up on what you said? For people who are interested in these issues, where do they get information?
Yeah. So if you go to our website, electrifypdx.org, we have a blog that has articles on all of these different topics organized with links, for instance, for community solar. We would recommend that you check out arcadia.com, which is one of the project managers that's working in the area to sign people up for community solar. But we have information on all of these topics on our blog.
I'm Lisa Loving. Our guests are Eli Spivak and Shannon Wilson from Electrify PDX. They're helping people convert their homes away from natural gas to all electric utilities. Your website, it talks a lot about the cost of fuel in the home. And we've just seen that the electrical prices, did they go up 17%? In Oregon, the Public Utility Commission agreed
on that.
Yeah,
I think
that.
Both
talk about the cost. Just talk
PGE
about the cost.
PGE and Pacific Power both just went up around 15%. And then Northwest Natural is also raising their rates this year.
Northwest Natural rates went up 42% in 18 months. And in order to meet the state's climate goals, they're going to keep going higher because it's harder for them to clean up their supply. And that's why heat pumps are so great, because heat pumps use literally one-third the energy, whether it's electricity or gas.
Can you talk about some of the other projects you're known for? What are all the cool things that you do around housing and also alternative electricity, alternative energy, alternative all kinds of things, actually? You're a very busy guy.
I'm also a parent of two kids, which is even more fun. But I love living in community, and I always have since living in group houses. And since I did affordable housing development to learn the ropes, I've been developing mixed income co-housing communities of different formats. I'm a developer with ADD. I try something out, and a typical developer would just do a lot of the times the same thing, and that would bore me. So I just do something different, and I'm always experimenting, and it's kind of fun that way. And the communities of homes that I build are really for people who want to live their values. They want to live in Portland. They want to be able to walk to things. They want to have a green home, a relatively small home, and be near other people. I've loved living in situations like that, especially raising a family. And in Portland, luckily, we have a wide variety of the community living situations, and I've developed some of them. And then on the land use side, I've been on the Planning Commission for a while in Portland, and we've really changed the rules here, and this is rolled out around the country now, to legalize less expensive housing choices, like accessory dwelling units or a little duplex, so that we have a wider variety of home choices in any neighborhood.
I was just going to ask you, why is it important to have these different kinds of housing?
Housing left to developers with single-family zoning ends up being like a monocrop of large homes, all on their own lots, separated from each other. And we are not a monocrop of people. We have people with all sorts of different family setups, size of household, stages of life, and we ought to have a housing variety that matches the variety of people we have. And people also want to be near each other. People get lonely, and that's a pandemic. I also work a lot with AARP nationally to help provide less expensive housing choices in existing neighborhoods people know and love. Legalizing accessory dwelling units, although it happened early on the West Coast, it's happening all over the country now for that reason.
As I'm talking with you, I'm just thinking about what you're saying. You're not even just creating housing. You're sort of creating communities of the future. I want to say, are you consciously doing that? You're shaping the community.
I don't think that far ahead. I think that a community that gets off to a good start will be a great community for a long time, long after I'm involved with it. I have a friend, Kevin Cavanaugh, who does some beautiful buildings in Portland. He says it really nicely that this stuff's going to outlast him. I try and experiment, and if something I do works well, then I'm happy for people to copy and run with it. But I do like to fiddle around with things that people maybe haven't tried yet.
I want to ask you this, Eli. What is your vision for the city of Portland?
I love Portland, and I'm an optimist about Portland, especially with our change of government. And I think this is a city where people want to take care of one another. And that's really a treasure in Portland. Our neighborhoods are awesome. So many wonderful little walkable spots we have in this city. And I was floored by how many people applied to serve on the different transition committees. It was huge. As this transition is happening, it's bringing out a lot of great energy from the city.
How are the ways that Portland's kind of divided? That's a hard question. Do you see Portland as being kind of divided?
There is a narrative that is out there that Portland has the blushes off the rose, or whatever the expression is. We are contending with some bigger city issues now, but I think that we still have the fundamentals. We have great folks. It's a diverse community. Lots of people want to get engaged. We have huge numbers of citizen advocates in Portland. They know what they're doing, and I feel really hopeful.
The more I interview people that are doing things in the community, the more hopeful I feel too. And then I pick up the Willy Week or the Oregonian and see, is Portland over? And that's what I'm talking about. It's a disconnect between different realities or different points of view. But I feel like Portland's really affected by politicians politicianing, just like everywhere, I guess, and you're from DC. You know, people will say, elected officials are going to say what they want to say to get people to vote for them. I've been here for 30 years, and I just see so much good stuff that nobody ever sees reflected back. I want to shift gears a little bit and say to Shannon, when you're working with people in this project, you're going to fairs and you've got the table and you're doing outreach and you're setting people up. What do they say to you? Like, what are people going through? What's important to them?
A lot of the people who we end up speaking to have some interest in electrification and climate, and they're very excited about the idea that they can have an impact in their home. And there's a lot of questions. Some people are hesitant. Some people are worried about giving up certain luxuries. And so we just assure them that electrification is far from a compromise. It's actually just full of benefits as far as comfort, efficiency, the lower utility bills. We just do a lot to encourage people to take action when they're sort of uncertain, but really looking for some way to have impact. One thing we constantly reinforce is that electrifying your home and powering it with clean energy is like pretty much one of the biggest climate actions that you can take. And that ends up really resonating with people and spurring them to take action.
Shannon, where do you want to see Electrify PDX go?
Well, we're really looking to grow our program. We'd love to be able to give more technical assistance to homeowners and renters and landlords who are looking to electrify so that we can answer their questions and help them really take those steps. We want to do a lot more outreach with the entire community and especially with the low-income community to just connect people with programs. I mean, when we did the electrification fair in October, I think everyone felt so excited to see so many other people excited about this. It sort of brought the whole movement out into the light. And so we want to do that a lot more.
We really want to be able to be resourced to have a staff position. They just did this in Missoula, Montana. They have a city-county partnership where they have someone who's there to help people go through that process. So that's one thing we would love to be able to do. Community Energy Project already provides that for low-income residents. We want to steer people that direction. But for people who are more affluent, who tend to have larger homes and bigger carbon impacts, we want to be able to help them. So that's one thing we want to grow into this coming year.
Cool. Community Energy Project is amazing. They've been around for a few minutes and they're expanding too. And I think they hired a lobbyist last year, which is fascinating. I know you told me you had a party for your first anniversary. Talk about it. What did you do? What happened?
Yeah, so we got volunteers and supporters together. We met at the Oakshire Beer Hall in Cully, and we just had a really fun celebration. There was cake. One of the exercises we did was just to invite people to share ideas for how we could do more outreach and expand our program, and it was a really fun night. Mm-hmm.
And we're ready to have more parties. When we have our next Electrify Portland event, we will once again have bouncy castles, free ice cream sandwiches, all sorts of great stuff. We really try and make it fun.
There are certain things that government doesn't do as well as people do. And that's a complicated thing to say. It's a complicated policy, but I think it's actually true. Shannon, you mentioned volunteers. For people listening right now, they want to get involved. What do volunteers do for you? Do you need more?
We were a pretty lean organization, but when we do throw big events, it's really helpful to have volunteers. One thing we just really want to encourage people to do is sign up for our program and then talk about electrification with their friends and family and loved ones and coworkers. That's one of the biggest kind of volunteer activities that someone can do for us probably right now.
Your engagement approach is really based on word of mouth. When people come to that event, it's like they know who the others are.
The other thing people can do is we're always looking for groups to present with. We present in neighborhood associations, faith communities, Earth Day events, all sorts of groups. If you are part of a group that would love to have a visit from us, let us know.
Eli, where will our city be in 20 years?
Well, we'll be awfully close to being a combustion-free city, which will be exciting. Less air pollution, less noise, healthier homes, healthier streets. So that's one thing in this energy world I really look forward to. But it's going to take a couple decades to get there.
What do you think, Shannon?
Oh, I would love to see
you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning into KBOO Community Radio for this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 3. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented volunteer programmers, including specials for Black History Month and International Women's Day. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $22,000 goal by March 16th, go to kboo.fm/give or text the letters KBOO to the number 44321. Do it right now.
Tune in to KBOO's International Women's